Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe. Well, there's been lots of stories in the media this year about people demanding protection from views and speech that cause offence. So we've heard about trigger warnings, microaggressions, and the rise of no platforming. And it seems as though the base assumption here is that tolerance is best served by shutting down debate. Is this ironic? Is it weird or contradictory? Well, we've got Natasha Moore and Simon Smart here to help us navigate this debate. Hey, Natasha.
Hi, Justine.
Hello, Justine.
Hello. Now, let's talk about no platforming, trigger warnings, microaggressions. Give us an example, Natasha. What story seems to sum up this phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole flood of them at the moment, isn't there? I mean, I think the no platforming is interesting. Actually, there's a period of the US spring now that's actually called disinvitation season because universities, you know, announce what speakers they're going to have for commencement, so for graduation speakers, and then students start objecting to those speakers and people are either withdraw or they're disinvited. So this has happened to some really remarkable people. So like Christine Lagarde, who's the first female head of the IMF, was disinvited from university because, you know, the objection was that the IMF underpins these patriarchal systems around the world. And therefore, from a feminist perspective, you couldn't have Christine Lagarde.
But everyone's likely to be found objectionable at some point, right? I mean, I think even Condoleezza Rice was no platformed. I may not agree with her politics, but I kind of want to hear what she has to say nonetheless.
Yeah, that's right. And Jermaine Greer, who recently, so this is not in the US, but Cardiff University.
In the UK,
They objected to her as a feminist because of the comments that she's made about transgender women. And so students objected that actually even having her on campus would be too harmful to the student population.
Yeah, let's pick up on that point because, I mean, surely it's not a bad thing that American and UK universities are mindful that their students should have a right to, you know, well-being and should have a safe space on campus. We have to give some credit there.
Yeah, so I mean, there are definitely good intentions at the heart of all of these stories, you know, that people don't want anybody to feel like they're being victimized or mocked or excluded. That's right. And particularly for groups that have been marginalized in the past and still are in lots of contexts. So I think, you know, there's a good-heartedness about that. But I think that probably the response to that has been wrong-headed. The assumption is that, well, if people say things that are offensive to others, the answer is to stop them being able to say it, to make sure that they are fired or they're not invited or they're shouted down on social media or whatever it might be. Whereas I think the more democratic approach to it is to try to engage with people who disagree with you, to say, I actually find your views offensive, but let's have a conversation about why, and let's actually listen to one another so that you can move forward in the debate instead of just silencing
so
one side of it.
Is it the silencing that you find most problematic, or is it also, you know, that there's an assumption that there is a right way, let's say, to think about whatever it is?
Yeah, so all of the above, right? What I find most worrying about it is what it says about the people who I disagree with. If I'm saying, actually, you're not allowed to voice that view that I find wrong or offensive or harmful, what I'm saying is I don't really care about you. I don't care if, you know, why you think that or what your background is that you've come to that conclusion. I don't care about trying to convince you of my point of view. I just don't want you to be allowed to express that view.
Is there not a some group or some opinions, though, where everyone would agree, or pretty much everyone, that we do not want those people in that context? So it's a matter of, you know, these things are relative and it's a matter of degrees, isn't it?
Well, I think that that kind of argument is in itself dangerous in that it's so relative. So some views that we would now consider mainstream used to be, you know, just a very small minority, and we would have thought it would be very safe to silence that minority. But actually, we would have all missed out on some correction of our views had we silenced them. So I think, you know, it's important because we're, as humans, we're not very good at being objective about other people's views. You know, we're not infallible. We are often wrong about things, even when lots of people agree with us. You know, the majority doesn't mean that we're right. Like, I think it's important to have quite a strong principle of freedom of speech, because we're not good at judging those individual cases, when it should be allowed and when it shouldn't.
So, Natasha, what does that mean? Is it rather than no platforming, should we be, you know, equal platforming everyone? And does this mean that, you know, your Holocaust denier gets the same right to speak in public about their views as the, you know, anti-vaxxer, as, you know, name any other member of a group whose views are perhaps out of step with society, let's say.
I don't think there's anyone really who defends the right of free speech. It's absolute that, you know, without restrictions, anyone should be able to say whatever they want in whatever forum. We always have restrictions on this. So one of those is incitement to violence. So if you have a white supremacist group who wants to get up and basically incite people to go and attack members of another race, we do have laws against that kind of direct harm that's inflicted on someone else. But I think we need to be careful about how far we push those restrictions. So for example, with the anti-vaccination campaigners, you know, I think it's right for there to be forums where that kind of information isn't available. So at a doctor's office, you don't have to give equal billing to pamphlets about vaccines and pamphlets against vaccines. But to call those ideas dangerous in the sense of incitement to violence, because they can potentially cause harm, I think any idea if people
could
have
be dangerous.
Could potentially be dangerous, because ideas matter. And, you know, if people believe them, then that has consequences for life. And the principle is, if an idea is dangerous, what do we do about that? Do we just shut them down and write them off? Or do we try to engage people and try to get to the heart of why they think what they think?
Well, what about the fact that a lot of us operate in sort of social media ghettos these days, where it's very easy to just go about your day and in some ways never come across an opinion that you actually disagree with?
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. Bill Clinton was quoted recently as saying that we only have one remaining bigotry. We don't want to be around anybody who disagrees with us. And, you know, that's actually increasingly possible for us because our societies can be so segregated. You know, we live near people who are like us and have similar incomes to us, similar political leanings. We have like this amazing availability of news and opinion, but we tend to exist in these sort of silos of people who, you know, we read things that we already agree with, yeah, that we already believe
in. It just makes us feel good,
and
really.
So I think that's quite dangerous for a democracy where you want to have people of really different opinions all living alongside one another and, you know, having that real respectful but robust exchange of ideas. So I think that's something we really need to, as individuals, you know, in our relationships, but also, you know, in public debate, be trying to work against.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're talking about the recent trend of policing potentially offensive ideas on American college campuses. But this sort of story isn't restricted to that setting. Have a listen to this.
Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name.
Thy kingdom come.
Thine will be done.
On earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day
our daily bread.
Forgive us our trespasses,
as we forgive those
who sin against us.
And lead us not into temptation,
but deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom,
the power and glory,
forever and ever.
Turns out that the Lord's Prayer is borderline offensive as well. The Church of England put together an ad where people from different walks of life each said a line from the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples to pray, and they wanted to screen it before the new Star Wars film. But it was actually prevented from screening for fear that it could offend people. The cinema chain has a policy of not featuring ads with political or religious messages. Now, Simon, what was your initial reaction to hearing about this story?
Well, my initial reaction was to go quickly and watch it, so to see the ad. And some people have said that perhaps this was a marketing ploy of the Anglican Church to get people to watch it, because the way these things tend to go, if you ban something, everyone wants to go and watch it. So, you know, maybe I'm sort of joking, really, but perhaps that was part of it. But that was my initial reaction. And when I went and saw it, I thought, well, you know, if, as it's being reported, this was banned, at least partly because it might cause offence, I think it's a really huge overreaction.
Tell us about the ad. What would people, if they'd been allowed to see it, what would it have offered them?
It's a beautifully shot ad. I think it would have been nice. It was meant to be in the lead up to Christmas. It was a very sort of inoffensive, as far as these things go, very inoffensive ad. Simply, as you said at the beginning, having people from a whole range of different walks of life in the UK praying one line of the Lord's Prayer. It's beautifully shot, and it was just sort of expressing what is the experience. It's going to paint you a picture of the experience of, you know, billions of people every day. This act of prayer, in a very ancient prayer, a sort of basic, simple prayer that Jesus taught people to pray. He said, do you want to learn to pray? This is not a bad place to start. And I'd say that's true. And so really the Anglican Church was just trying to give people that thought in the lead up to Christmas. And maybe, you know, as they're about to watch Star Wars, some people would think that, you know, that was a very deliberate thing, I guess, to get them to think about not the force, but the
real
ultimate,
force,
the
I
real
suppose.
Force, they might call it. So that's what they would have seen. My view is that they, for the believers, it would have given them a bit of encouragement. For the people who really aren't at all interested, I don't think they would have cared too much. And for the people who are a bit unsure, at least would have given them a language with which to approach such a thought. This idea that you might pray to something greater than yourself, which is very much the experience of most people in their lives at some point.
It may be the experience of most people, but this ad was quite Christian, right? And it was praying the Lord's Prayer, which is, you know, obviously has specific resonance within a Christian tradition. So do you think that the ad stirred up trouble because it was specifically Christian? Would an ad from another kind of religion have caused the same outrage?
Well, I don't know. Maybe. It does seem that in a lot of Western countries today, there's a real push against particularly Christianity. And it did feel a little bit like that. I mean, it seems a bit sad that something that was so culturally important in the UK for a long time is now thought of as potentially offensive. But perhaps that is a function of having been the ones who've held the keys for so long. And perhaps Christians should just get used to that. Now not being in such a powerful position, perhaps there's a bit of resentment. And people, you know, expect them to just, you know, cop it for some period of time.
There was a claim that said that people of other faiths and people of no faith would actually be offended by such an ad.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I think that's completely dishonest. I don't see that in any sense. I mean, apart from someone who's a really strident opponent of a particular religion, in this case Christianity, most people who are religious just expect that people of other faiths, like them, have their beliefs and their practices, their rituals, their symbols and things that they participate in that they do, and they know that the others do as well, and they expect that people take that seriously. So most people, let's say the Buddhist person or the Jewish person, they're not going to be offended by this. They know that this is a very important part of the Christian story, and they'd expect Christians to carry it out. When people go down that track, it does feel like that attempt, really, at bottom, to sort of rid the public square of anything that looks religious.
It also seems to me that it doesn't give the public much credit. Like, it seems to view them quite pessimistically. Like, everyone's on the outrage alert, you know what I mean? Like, they're just waiting to be triggered, and then they're going to get angry, and then, you know, they'll be hell to pay.
Well, there's plenty of ads that all of us go to before the cinema. I went to the cinema the other day. There were 25 minutes of ads and some shorts. There's a lot of stuff there that doesn't cohere with my worldview, but we're a very brittle society if we can't come up against worldviews that are different from our own and sort of throw our hands in the air and say we're so wounded by that. We have to be able to, a bit like Natasha was sort of pushing for earlier here, we have to be able to exist with and engage with people with very different views from our own and be able to sort of live well together. It doesn't mean you agree with them, but you have to engage.
Yeah, it seems that it's fundamentally something democratic that we're talking about, because even if people, you know, in college situations can shut down ideas that they're not interested in engaging with or that they're offended by, you can't do that in the real world. And it's best that, I suppose, that everyone is exposed to those sorts of experiences now so they can learn to debate and discuss with them rather than kind of scrubbing our public spaces clean of words, ideas and images and whatever that will give us offence.
Yeah, I mean, in actual fact, you can do that in the real world. There are countries where they do that. But we know that we don't want to be a society like that. And I think we've forgotten that that's not a given, that actually that's something we need to work hard at if we want to be a society where different ideas can be tested out and expressed and believed.
So debate should always be on the table and never off limits. That's what Life and Faith has to say about that. Thanks, guys. See you next time.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. For more on this topic and many more besides, go to publicchristianity.org.